Now, we begin the talk tonight with the generating, each of us, as much as we can, generate the attitude of refuge, confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, the three jewels. And the great purpose, the supreme attitude of intending to achieve our potential of Buddhahood in order to become perfect guides, to lead others out of the suffering of the cyclic existence. We'll recite the Buddha's mantra three times, Teyata Om Muni Muni Maha Muniye Soha.
Teyata Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Soha. Tayata Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Soha. Tayata Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Soha.
Now, in relation to our topic of karma, talking about karma, in the first two talks we've discussed the Four Noble Truths, at least the first two in detail, and then last week we went into a preliminary investigation into karma in terms of the 10 naturally non-virtuous actions. So I hope what we've understood so far is that the term karma refers to the mental activity of intention or purpose or will. So all the time, we are, you know, throughout the day, we are constantly doing things, or saying things, or thinking about things, and there is our own mind is the one behind what we are doing, saying, and thinking about. And we refer to different qualities of our mind as mental factors. And one of the primary mental factors is the mental factor of intention or purpose or will behind our actions. So there's always some intention behind what we do. We may think, oh no, I just totally spontaneously, I do this and that. But actually, we are not totally spontaneous in our activities. There's always the ever-present mental activity of intention or purpose. And in a mind such as ours, like we can divide our beings into ordinary beings, those whose minds are contaminated by ignorance or associated with ignorance, and extraordinary beings, such as Buddhas, whose minds are totally free from ignorance. So those whose minds are contaminated by manifest ignorance, which means confusion about reality, and not just not knowing reality, but grasping at the wrong appearance of things, or grasping at things to exist as they appear to us. But unfortunately, we don't know the way our own self appears to us when we think of I or me and others and the objects of the world appear to exist from their own side, inherently, concretely, without depending upon any other conditions. That appearance is wrong, but we don't know that. So in our daily life, as we're intending, we're doing this, we're doing that, we're thinking about this, we're saying this and that, we are relating to a world which is very distorted in our apprehension. Our minds are obscured by this fundamental ignorance. And so when we do purposeful actions, whether they're virtuous or non-virtuous, then our actions are, how do you say, they're not in accord with reality. And there are effects of our actions. So the term karma refers to the intention, the purpose behind our deluded mental actions. And whatever we do, as you know, we've talked about in the previous week, there is the immediate result. We may intend to help somebody or harm somebody, and we go about the physical or verbal action to help or harm that person. So the immediate result is what we intended. The person either feels happy or unhappy according to what we intended to do, or in relation to them. That's not the end of the story. That the intention, this mental activity of intention, which connects our mind with the object, you know, it associates our consciousness, our mind, with the things in the world. And so there's a subjective purpose behind our connecting with things. So as that intention brings about its result, harming somebody or helping somebody, the intention does not, well, the manifest intention stops once the deed has been done. But it remains as a potency born upon the mind stream, a potency which has the power or the capacity to bring about a further experience, either in this life or future life. And that the way in which we call these karmic potencies, right? They're not karma, because karma is intention, not purpose. But the potency established by our intended actions, it remains like a seed, a dry seed, which retains its potency to ripen into a plant when the conditions of moisture and warmth and so on come together. Then that seed, which remained dormant, has the potential to bring about a new plant. So we have these dormant potencies born on our mind stream, which when the appropriate conditions occur in sometime in the future, that potency ripens as what? As a mental factor of intention, a purpose, an active element in our consciousness, which will connect our mind with a particular object. And we have a particular experience. Right? So it is, the potencies are born from intention, they remain dormant, and then they ripen as an intention, a purpose. Therefore, as we ordinary beings, whose minds are contaminated by ignorance, our minds are constantly experiencing different impulses, purposes, intentions to do things. And every single experience we have, every pleasant experience, every unpleasant experience, has the ripening of a karmic potency behind that experience. Without that karmic potency, we would not experience that moment or moments of pleasure or pain. So in this way, for us ordinary beings, the unveiling of our life, the day-to-day experience, is the continual continual ripening of karmic potencies. Now, this does not mean that our life is predetermined by karma. It is one condition behind our experience. It's not definite what's going to happen, from moment to moment in life, because other conditions are lots of other mental factors are associated with every experience. And there are virtuous mental factors or wholesome mental factors. So, generosity, kindness, patience, love, wisdom, and so on. And there are unwholesome mental factors. Self-grasping, or better say, anger, desire, attachment, pride, jealousy, spitefulness, there's a whole bunch. So, if we could, if we're watching a video, we can put it on hold, and we can stop the motion of what's on the screen, and we can analyze lots of different things that are happening in the picture. So, similarly, if we stop our stream of consciousness for a moment, then we can analyze, there's intention, there's always intention, connecting the mind with object, there's always some sort of feeling, pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, or neutral feeling. This is always there. There's always a degree of distinguishing the object which our mind is experiencing. There's always a degree of engagement. It's like intention leads our mind to the object in general, and then we engage with the object. We have contact with the object, and we engage in a deeper way with the various qualities of the object. So this is the way our mind's operating all the time. Then, as well, there are, as I mentioned, wholesome or unwholesome mental factors manifesting. And we're not always angry. Anger comes, goes. We're not always loving. The virtuous mind of love, not attachment, which most people think is love. Mind is alternating between virtue and non-virtue, or wholesome and unwholesome thoughts or attitudes constantly throughout the day. As well as that, the fluctuation of the mind from virtue, non-virtue, we've got all of these karmic potencies which are ripening. So, a karmic potency that is established on the mind stream by a virtuous deed, the thought to make somebody happy and do that action, that will ripen through causing an intention which will make our mind, or me, you know, we always say me, but there's no me independent from the mind, right? Which me is just a label on the body and mind. So whenever the mind is in a virtuous attitude, that is the suitable soil to nurture a virtuous karmic potency. And so the combination of the pre-existing karmic potency and the virtuous intention brings about a pleasant experience. And similarly, when the mind is in anger or very agitated, very greedy, whatever, and in a negative state, that is the suitable state of mind to ripen, to germinate an unwholesome karmic potency, and then we will meet with an unpleasant experience. So even though the unfolding of our lives is the unfolding of past, of karmic potencies created in the past, there is not a roadmap for our life. It's not planned, it's not determined by karma, because the emotional attitude is changing all the time. And we can consciously recognize, say we're angry, we can say, oh, anger is no good, I don't like this, I'm going to get rid of this. And so when we're getting impatient, we're not yet angry, right? We're not too happy, but we realize that our mind at any moment can explode in anger, as it habitually has in the past. With this knowledge of the faults of anger, we can consciously block an angry response, apply an antidote, an opposite thought, and instead of having an angry reaction, we can have a positive reaction to whatever situation is upsetting us. So you see, we have, this is the great news, right, about karma. We have the capacity to steer our life in a direction towards more and more happiness, less and less unhappiness. And as we do so, then our mind becomes much more capable of generating the knowledges, the wisdom of listening, of reflecting, and of meditating. So that subjectively, our mind becomes stronger and stronger. Eventually, when we reach the point of having direct realization of emptiness, which opposes, negates the root confusion, the root ignorance that makes the whole world so distorted and makes it, you know, it appears wrongly, and we grasp at that wrong appearance to be true. So when we have the wisdom opposing that ignorance, not just intellectually, but in meditative concentration, single point of concentration, at that point, we extinguish all karmic potencies. They cannot ripen. At that point, we're not yet enlightened. We've got a long way to go. But at that point, we destroy karmic potencies, and we won't create any more, because we have nullified the root ignorance behind karmic creation. One is called not an ordinary being, one is a noble being or an Arya being. And from that point on, one will progressively eliminate the seeds of the disturbing emotions, the seeds of ignorance, seeds of anger, seeds of attachment, through the power of the renunciation, bodhicitta, and wisdom, realizing emptiness. if you're on the Bodhisattva's path, or if you're on the ordinary path, the Hinayana path, we eliminate the seeds of the afflictions through concentration, through morality, and through wisdom. All right. So that's just sort of, hopefully, what the first 2 weeks have brought us to understand, that our future is in our own hands. It's not in anybody else's hand. It's not Buddha's hand. The Buddhas can help us, the Lamas can help us, but it's up to you and me to make the decision to cleanse our minds, to train in renunciation, bodhicitta, and wisdom, and get out of this mess, right? So tonight we're going to talk about how we get into the mess in more detail. The 12 links of interdependent origination. So this is a discussion. It's sort of, any karmic potency, as we mentioned last week, karmic potencies can cause different types of result. One potency can cause one rebirth or multiple rebirths. And any one rebirth can be caused by one potency or by multiple potencies. So there's a great variety of ways in which karma brings about its effects. So rebirth result is the big one. And then there's the result also coming from karmic potencies of what happens during that rebirth. So that, as we've already said, every pleasant and every unpleasant experience throughout life that we've taken is one condition behind them is the what we call completing karma. Karma which completes the rebirth. And so we have but to be born human is a result of a wholesome, a virtuous karmic potency. In our past life, we died very skillfully and we nurtured, our mind nurtured a potency for a human rebirth. But during that rebirth, it's not all roses and, it's sometimes pleasant, sometimes unpleasant. It fluctuates. That's due to the great, vast accumulation of completing karma or from karmic potencies from both this life and from past lives. All right? As we progress, you're welcome to put your hand up and ask if it's not clear. So, good questions. Just brushing your hair. Okay. Now, in terms of rebirth karma, I mentioned that last week that the karma for rebirth, the karmic potency, is ripened as we're dying. As we're dying, there are the five stages of death. Well, first, the weakening of the body, and then there's the weakening of our feelings, our capacity to feel strong, happiness, unhappiness. Neutral feeling, mind becomes very even. Then there's a weakening of our capacity to distinguish different things. And one thing we have the capacity to distinguish is to distinguish between virtue and non-virtue. And through that distinguishment with knowledge, we have the capacity to make our mind virtuous and abandon non-virtue. If we don't have that knowledge or that habit, during death we can be very upset. The mind will be in non-virtue, and if we are habitually angry or greedy or grasping, whatever, it will stay in that aspect. Then after that period of where we're still able to distinguish things but we're losing that capacity, then we sink into the the deeper or the finer or the more subtle aspects of dying, where the all of the emotions, positive and negative emotions, weaken, and then the consciousness itself, the mental consciousness, becomes more and more subtle, going right down to the final moment of consciousness, what we call the clear light vision, which happens after we stop breathing. So the karmic potency for the next life is ripened by our mind during that third period of dying, the weakening of our capacity to discriminate or distinguish between things, between right and wrong and so on. And it ripens as a mental factor of intention, as all karmic potencies give rise to a mental factor of intention. And that intention becomes more and more subtle as we go into the more subtle levels of death. But it's not totally disappeared, and it doesn't go back to being a potency. At the moment of death, when the mind in its most subtle state, the clear light, separates from the body, like a beam balance, you know, as one arm goes down, the other goes up. So the point of death is when they're equal, and they move, and then death occurs, and then the bardo, the intermediate existence between one life and the next, arises. And so the intention that ripened our rebirth, to determine our rebirth, then becomes more manifest. And the body of the bardo being is formed from the subtle wind energy which supports consciousness. The shape of that body is determined by the mind, which is primarily determined by that very intention that arose as a result of the ripening of the karma for the next life. So this body of the intermediate state being, in Buddhism, we call it a mental body, because it is the mind which has determined what it looks like. And there can be karma, it can be ripened to any of the realms of rebirths, a hell being, hungry ghost being, an animal, a human, or a divine being, various levels of divine being. So, whatever karma ripened, the intermediate state being will be in the aspect of that, according to that karmic, the ripening of that karmic potency. The form, those who, you know, the three realms, the desire realm, the form realm, and the formless realm. In the formless realm, there's no bardo. When one dies and one's mind instantly is born into the formless realm, where there is no gross physical body. There is a subtle body, but there's no bardo. But for the form realm, which is, and the desire realm, there is a bardo existence. Now, in the 12 things, it tries to simply talk about one rebirth karma being ripening, and then the 12 links, you know, going through to the end of that life thrown by those 12 links. But it's not just the type of rebirth that is determined by karmic ripening as we're dying. Also, our lifespan, the duration of the future lifespan is determined by the karmic ripening that occurs during the weakening of the capacity for discriminating awareness as we were dying. So for humans, each baby has a karmically determined lifespan. That, under ordinary conditions, that cannot be extended. But we can even die before our karmically determined lifespan is up. You know, if we do, you know, certain activities which, you know, put ourselves in danger stupidly and eat things, there are things we can do which can cause our death before our karmic lifespan is completed. So we can't live beyond our karmic lifespan, but we can die before our karmically determined lifespan. Also, our gender is determined, at least our psychological gender is determined during the ripening. In the teachings on the Bardo experience, and sometimes, not every human Bardo experience, it's taught in the Abhidhamma that if your karma had ripened to be born male, then you will have a vision. It doesn't always happen like this, but you have a vision of the future parents in sexual intercourse. And if your karma was to be a male, you'll feel desire towards a physical desire towards the future mother and hostility towards the father. The desire will attract you to the meeting of the sex organs, and the aggression will cause a death of the intermediate existence. The mind will go down to the clear light and will enter the ovum at fertilization or after fertilization, or maybe even before fertilization. It doesn't say, but round about fertilization. If your karma had ripened from the previous life to be born female, you'll have this, you know, the opposite. You'll have desire for the future father, aggression towards the future mother, and so you'll be reborn. So, I was talking to people the other day that there is a karmic cause for a psychological gender. But in my opinion, purely my opinion, whether a sperm carrying an X chromosome or a sperm carries a Y chromosome fertilizes the ovum in the mother's womb is chance. I don't think it's karma. What we do about it is karma. The experience is karma. But whether it's, you know, an X or a Y chromosome is chance. Which means that 50% of us are psychologically mismatched. There's a mismatch between our karmic psychological tendency for male, masculine or feminine mind and our physical, our chromosomal cause for a male or a female body. 50% mismatch. So it seems to me that this is a very interesting explanation for what we know. In every society, every human society, there's a whole spectrum of individuals who go from, how do you say, their psychological and their physical gender are matched, apparently matched, and they live a life as a heterosexual male or female. And then the other end of this spectrum are those who have what we call gender dysmorphia, where there's incredible inner conflict because one feels that one is a woman in a man's body or a man in a woman's body. And so, and then in between, there's everything in between. This is a reality. And I think this explanation of karma gives a reasonable explanation of what's going on. Now, we all have masculine and feminine qualities in our mind. In past life, we've been both male and female, you know, countless times. We're not always the same gender. And there are qualities that we can distinguish, which we can collectively group. These are more masculine qualities, these are more feminine qualities. And each of us, actually, we have the capacity to utilize our feminine qualities or our masculine qualities under changing conditions where it's suitable, where we have control. We shouldn't feel ashamed about using a mental quality which is opposite to our physical gender. In fact, it's an incredible advantage and a power and a gift, even gift from karma, to act skillfully. Because all sorts of situations are happening in life. And if we only have a male-oriented view, it's very narrow. It is associated with more aggression, more stubbornness. I won't go into the classification of what's masculine or feminine, because it could be. But there are these qualities. The feminine side is more associated with intuitive wisdom, like direct understanding, desire, sensory desire, seems to be more strongly associated with a feminine quality. In Tantra, we train both our masculine and feminine qualities to unite in one state of mind. The quintessential feminine quality is wisdom. Quintessential masculine quality is active compassion. So wisdom is great, but without compassion, not so good. And compassion is great, but without wisdom, our compassion is not so effective. Buddhahood is a state of mind where wisdom and compassion are united as one mind, one blissful state of consciousness. And all confusion, all self-centeredness, all anger, attachment and so on have been extinguished. Karma was extinguished a long time ago. Buddhist mind still have intention, but it's not intention associated with an ignorant mental continuum. It's intention associated with pure wisdom and compassion. So it's impossible for a Buddha to do the wrong thing. But Buddhas are limited by us. Even Shakyamuni Buddha's cousin, Devadatta, was intensely jealous of the historic Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, and tried in so many different ways to kill the Buddha, to contradict and do the opposite. Which is a very good teaching that even the Buddha cannot remove our problems. But there's something which we can do which Buddhas cannot do. Remove our problems and their causes. Only we can do that. Each one of us. Yeah, refuge and trust in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha is very important. Particularly when we're dying. During that period of the weakening of our capacity of discrimination and distinguishment, if we remember our teacher and the Buddha, the Dharma, Sangha, we generate, have what we call refuge or faith. That is a virtuous state of mind. And even we've lived a terrible life, if we can generate that faith and confidence in the Buddha as we're dying, we must have a happy rebirth. Because that wholesome attitude of faith nurtures a virtuous karmic potency for a human or a divine rebirth. So again, we depend upon Buddha and the Dharma, the teachings, to learn about this. But whether we put what we've learned into action is up to us. So we have to know that. We have to remember that and not be complacent. Not think, oh, I've done enough, I don't have to do any more, I can let it go. We have to consciously watch our mind. All right. So that's the sort of introduction to the 12 links. Now, the 12 links, I'm sure you've seen images, and there's probably a painting outside. The 12 links of interdependent origination. So this cycle of 12 explains the activity of a karmic potency, bringing about the rebirth result. And the first, we begin with ignorance. The ignorance, not knowing reality. And on top of not knowing reality, is grasping at the mistaken conception of how things exist, because they appear to exist wrongly, and we grasp at that appearance to be correct. So there's ignorance. Then the second is karmic formation. So because the mind is ignorant, then there is there are the wholesome mental factors, such as generosity, love, compassion, but those wholesome mental factors are still associated with ignorance. Ignorance itself is not unwholesome, it's not non-virtuous, the link, the first link. It is what, in Buddhist terms, they call Buddha, it's unpredicted. Buddha did not say or predict whether the link, ignorance, is virtuous or non-virtuous. So it's sort of neutral or unpredicted. So with a wholesome, ignorant mind, we create a virtuous potency which is placed upon the mind stream. So that second link is called the karmic action. The third link is called consciousness, because the potency is born upon the stream of consciousness. And so that third link, called consciousness link, has what we call the causal consciousness. So the causal consciousness link lasts from the moment the potency was laid upon it, right through until the first moment of consciousness in the new life, which will be caused by that karma. And that first moment of consciousness in the life that has been caused by that karma is called the resultant consciousness link. Okay? So ignorance, karmic formation, consciousness link, carrying that karmic potency through into the future life. Then, having taken a future life, there is you now have the continuum of mind from past lives and a new body. It's a new body, the embryo in a future mother's womb. So you have mind and form or name referring to the mind and the form, the body, which supports that mind. Then during development, so that's the fourth link, name and form, or body and mind, at the moment of conception. Now, because the karma, let's say we're talking about a human rebirth, the karma had ripened, we've had a human appearing mental body in the bardo, male or female, and then we've got the mind is now in association with a developing embryo in a human mother's womb. So now you've got the chromosomal influence in developing the body, as well as the mental influence. But you didn't have chromosomes in the bardo, but you've got them now in the new life. And so the development of the embryo is not purely chromosomal. You know, at first, there's a bunch of grapes or something. Looks like a bunch of grapes. Or the cells start to multiply. Then they're organized. They're organized into a human embryo and eventually a human fetus. So the mind plays an important role in that organizing of the embryo into a human embryo, human fetus. So with that development, there's a development of the six faculties for experience. So there are the five faculties for visual experience, auditory, smell, taste, and touch, the five senses, as well as the sixth faculty, or the sixth consciousness, what we call the mental consciousness. So the next link, the fifth link, is called the six sources. And that is the development of the fetus, and that until all is, the fetus is ready to be born, and the sense organs in general are usually all there, and the mental consciousness. Of course, other things can happen during development in the womb, but we're just talking about an ordinary, unaffected pregnancy. Then there's birth. And so birth brings about the end of that fifth link, the six sources. And as soon as the baby's born, there is contact of the senses, the sense organs, with their objects. The baby experiences light, which is hurts, and touch, like temperature, which is cold, and they're shivering, and they screw up their eyes because the light's hurting, and the sound is probably hurting them as well. Smell and taste. And the mental consciousness. So, at birth, there is the sixth link of contact. Contact of the mind through its various sense organs with the objects of each particular type of consciousness. Yes?
During being in the womb, doesn't the baby experience the suffering of contact?
But it's not the link contact. When we talk about the 12 links, we're talking about the 12 steps associated with one particular rebirth karma. And so link ignorance is different from the ignorance which is the root of psychic existence. Sometimes they're the same, sometimes they're not the same. So if you want to go into detail, link ignorance is either acquired or innate, not knowing reality. Okay, so the root of psychic existence is the ignorance, not knowing reality. But it's not the innate ignorance. Sorry, it's not the acquired ignorance. So something which is both the root of psychic existence and the ignorance of the first link is the innate self-grasping ignorance. Something which is, there are four, how do you say, four ways of looking at it. Something which is the root ignorance, which is the link ignorance but not the root ignorance, is the acquired self-grasping ignorance. Anyway, there is sensory experience during the development of the sense organs of an embryo, of a fetus. Yes, but that's not the contact link. That's the mental factor of contact, but it's not the link. By definition, the definition of the sixth link, the contact link, is contact with objects of awareness after birth. Huh? So yes, to answer your question, yes, there is contact in the womb, but it's not the link. So as a result of contact, it's necessarily feeling. That's the seventh link. And feelings are either pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings, or neutral feelings. They're going to be physical or mental. So that's the seventh link. We have no choice. Every baby is born without choice. As soon as the mind enters the womb at conception, then you have all three factors required for conception: sperm, ovum, and stream of consciousness. The sperm and ovum, even if they unite, cannot create consciousness. They cannot create mind. A developing nervous system in the embryo or the fetus cannot create mind. Mind is a continuum of awareness that's non-physical. It exists as a continuum of previous moments of consciousness. So the consciousness of a newborn baby, where the mother's still pregnant or after birth, necessarily comes from a previous life. Doesn't come from the parents' minds, otherwise the child would have the memories and the knowledge of the parents, which it doesn't have. Anyway, feeling. Now, at this, the feeling link, right, the feeling link is a time when new sets of 12 links can ripen. Because the mind still has ignorance, when there's pleasant feeling, there is necessarily desire and attachment for those pleasant objects and pleasant experiences. And when there's unpleasant feelings, there's aversion, anger, hostility towards the objects, the unpleasant objects. And so you've got all the conditions for new karmic formations. So the ignorance is no longer the ignorance link. There is still ignorance, but it's the root of psychic existence. Self-grasping ignorance, which becomes a new number one link to create a new karmic formation to establish a whole new set of 12 links. Right? Now, remember, throughout life, we are always experiencing either pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings, or neutral feelings. There's no third or no fourth alternative. And in our ignorant mind, every time we experience pleasure, we generate attachment to that pleasure. We do something out of attachment. We set up a whole new set of 12 links, a different set of 12 links. Every time we have an unpleasant experience, we have aversion, and we do something out of hostility or anger, we set up a new set of 12 links associated with that feeling. So can you see the incredible, unimaginable numbers of sets of 12 links that we are going through. In this seventh link of feeling, scary. And yes, it's karma was one condition behind the pleasant feeling and the unpleasant feeling. But whether we reacted with anger or patience, with attachment or genuine love, that is up to us. That is the opening, the potential to take control of our karma rather than be controlled by our karma. And only we can do that. Buddhists can't do that for us. They can show us how, but it's up to us to do it. Yeah.
Does it make sense for us to not try to enjoy?
Does it make sense to not try to enjoy? Yes, become a monk or a nun.
And assume effectively a neutral position.
Hey?
To then assume...
To make the mind neutral.
To adopt a neutral position in relation to experiences.
No, the point is, drop neutral, drop attachment and aversion, but cultivate wisdom, love, compassion, patience. Right? That's what makes sense. To remain neutral is useless. You can create neutral karma, meaningless. We've got the chance to destroy karma from the root. So, you take vows of abstinence from mundane pleasures of life, become a monk or a nun. That gives you the freedom to train your mind, to learn more, train your mind, and to practice without being caught up in society, in the social whirlpool, the chaos of society. It's not essential. One can remain within society, family, etc., etc., and still study, contemplate, and meditate, and become enlightened. You do not have to become a monk or a nun. It's the easy way out for those who can't control their desire, their attachment, in any other way. Okay, so we're at the seventh link. So, okay, from we're born, we're creating more sets of 12 links. And throughout life, towards the end of life, assuming, our lifespan was reasonably long, the next two links are called craving and grasping. So the eighth link is craving. And we crave, the pleasures of our sensory pleasures. We crave to be free from unpleasant things. So there's craving to be at peace and away from unpleasant things. And so the mind becomes more strongly grasping or connected with this, with existence. And so that's the ninth link, is grasping. And this craving and grasping usually refer to attachment, strong attachment and aversion close to the time of death. So, we grasp, as I mentioned, we crave and grasp the pleasures of the five sense objects. We crave and grasp at our views, our mistaken views about life. And especially, we grasp at ourself, this number one, this me, who we've cherished throughout life and looked after. Number one priority has generally been me. My pleasure, my freedom from pain. So this becomes very strong at the time of death, or as we're beginning to approach death and dying. So these two, craving and grasping, now we're talking about 12 links. So the craving and grasping belonging to a particular set of 12 links, they are the conditions which nurture the karmic potency belonging to that set of 12 links. So they're like the water and you know, the moisture and the heat and the sunlight which germinates a seed. When craving and grasping grow very strong, and then as we're approaching death and we're beginning to experience the, what we call the death absorptions, the experience of the five stages of death, they nurture a dormant karmic potency which will ripen during that period of dying when we lose our power of discrimination, or as we're losing our power of discrimination. So there is a third mental attitude in operation at this point. We have craving and grasping at existence. The third is whether the mind is wholesome or unwholesome. And if we have trained before we face the shock of death, if we trained our mind to consciously be in the aspect of virtue and abandon non-virtue or unwholesome, then the third factor during this state is whether our mind is in a wholesome or an unwholesome state. So you see, we potentially have the power to maintain our mind in virtue. And even if we've created so much non-virtue, if we can do that as we're dying, that would germinate a wholesome karmic potency for a rebirth as a human or a divine being. It won't, we still carry with us into that next life the dormant, unwholesome potencies of an unhappy rebirth. They still go with the mind. You haven't escaped them. And it depends what happens in the next life, whether they're going to ripen or not. Hopefully, we'll be born in a situation where we can continue learning about the mind, about karma, and we can reach that point of single-pointed concentration on emptiness, where we can extinguish them, and they will never have to ripen. They will be gone forever. That's not an easy point to get to, but it's possible. Okay, so existence is the name of the tenth link. We're craving and grasping with the eighth and ninth links. The tenth link is called existence. It's called existence because it's given that name according to its effect. Its effect is the next existence, the next rebirth. So it's called existence. What is it? What is that tenth link from what we've been talking about? What is it in terms of the mind? It's the mental factor of intention, right? We started off with intention. The intention, the purposeful will behind our action created the dormant karmic potency. That all karmic potencies ripen as mental factor of intention. I've mentioned completing karma throughout life. It is an intention, a karmic intention, which connects us with pleasant or unpleasant objects during life or experiences during life. Similarly, the tenth link is the dormant karmic potency has been nurtured by craving and grasping to the point of germination. And what is it? What is the tenth thing? It is, once again, the mental factor of intention or purpose. And as I mentioned before, that manifests, but then we continue dying, and the mind becomes more subtle. But that intention does not become dormant again. It becomes more and more subtle, down to the clear light. Even in clear light, there is mental effect of intention. And then the beam balance changes. One life finishes, left life begins. The mind separates from the body, and the reverse of the death process occurs, goes through subtle visions to the consciousness of the bardo state, the intermediate state. And that very continuum of intention will determine the appearance of the bardo body. The bardo body, the substantial cause of the bardo body is the subtle wind, which is always inseparable from subtle mind. But the mind of the subtle body is the mind which came from the past life, of the bardo being, came from the past life. And that mind has the karmically ripened mental factor of intention. So if a karma for human rebirth ripened, the bardo body will be a mental body in the appearance of a small human. If the karma to be a dog had ripened, the substantial cause of the body, the subtle wind, will be, moulded into the aspect of a dog's body. In the bardo, you'll be a dog bardo being. And then it all happens. So, the 11th link is rebirth. And the 12th link is aging and death. Everything that is born will die. Or every being who is born, every ordinary being who is born will die. So that's sort of a general idea of the 12 links. Now, they don't occur in exactly the sequence 1 through to 12. The 12 links of any single particular karmic potency associated with one karmic potency can occur either in two lives or in three lives, no more, and not one life. Although there is a school in Buddhism, the Abhidharma, the school, which talks about the 12 links all happening in one life. It's very interesting. I had never studied, not in this life, studied the schools of Buddhist thought. That the higher schools, they're sort of greater, the higher schools say, oh no, it's not quite like that. It's two lives or three lives. But I had no idea. And I'd done courses with the lamas. First Kopan and then the Chenrezig Institute. The very first course at Chenrezig Institute back in 1975. And then Lama Yeshe, I told him I wanted to do a retreat, so he gave instruction to do a retreat. So I did 3 months. I built a cabin in the bush near Coffs Harbour, and for 3 months didn't see it. Meditated on the Lama Rim, 12 links and so on. And then afterwards I wrote to Lama Yeshe, said, I want to become a monk. When? He said, oh, come to Kopan. So I went back to Melbourne. I was working in a hospital, getting some money together to become a monk. And Tara House had just been started, and it was in the home of Inta McKim. She was a psychologist, and she had a small house in Fitzroy. And so they had regular meetings, and and I was about to go and become a monk, and they asked me if I'd give a talk. My very first Dharma talk. I'll talk about the 12 links, which I thought I understood. But I talked about the 12 links in relation to one life, which is what I thought was very logical. Some of you may have met Miffy. Her aunt's daughter, she was about 6 years old, and she was at that talk. Anyway, we got ordained, I got ordained with a group of others, and we took Getsal ordination. We're all at Tashida Retreat Center in Dharamsala, this is the following year. And so we'd taken ordination, so we all sat down and we had a discussion. And one of the older, he's been a monk for a long time, at least 18 months. So he was like, wow. He said, anyway, he asked me about the 12 links, and I said, yes, they can occur in one life. And everybody looked at me. And I was sort of smashed to the ground. But then later I read, oh yes, the Vibhasika school says they can all occur in one life. I went, ah! Here it is. So look, 12 rulings in one life, okay? So, in one life, you do let's say you create the karma to be a dog. You do something harmful. You create a karmic potency to be a dog. So there's the ignorance link, there's the karmic formation link, and there's the consciousness link. Okay? Associated with that karma to be a dog. Then at the end of that life, you have craving and grasping, which nurture that karmic potency. So this belongs to the same set of 12 links. And so you've got 1, 2, 3, 8, 9, and 10. The 10th link of existence that ripens during the dying. And so you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You've got 6. And then, so you ripen the karma to be born, you're reborn as a dog. So you've got the name and form, you've got the 6 sources, you've got contact, and you've got feeling. Well, yeah, you've got feeling, and there's rebirth, and there is death, aging and death. So you've got six links associated with one karma in the first life, and then the 6 associated with that same karma in the second life. Now, if that's the 12 links occurring in 2 lives. Now, in 3 lives, you create the first 3 in the first life, ignorance, karmic formation, and consciousness. But when you die during that life, craving and grasping ripen another karmic potency, not the same karmic potency. So that would be craving and grasping belonging to another set of 12 links, not this set of 12 links. So it may be rebirth as a human. So you get in the second life, you have the name and, yeah, what do you have? You have the name and form, the rebirth, 6 sources, etc., relating to the other karmic one, not this one to be born as a dog. But towards the end of that human rebirth, your craving and grasping do nurture that karma to be a dog. So you have 8th, 9th and 10th links occurring in the second life. And then in the third life, you've got rebirth, name and form, 6 sources, contact and feeling, and aging and a death, as a dog. So associated with that karma to be a dog. So that's the karma, the 12 links occurring over three lives. Now, that's when they occur. But in that second life, you need not necessarily have ripened that karma to be a dog. You can have a billion lifetimes experiencing other sets of 12 links, and only after the billionth lifetime do you actually complete the, through craving and grasping, do you complete that original karma a billion lifetimes ago to be reborn as a dog. That will not fade away, that potency. It cannot fade away from its own side. But the 12 links only occur during three lives, but there are many in between when they're not manifesting. So what do we do about it? Nobody wants to die if you grow old and die. So what's the cause of growing old and dying? It's being born. So the 12th link is caused by the 11th link. And with what is being born created by, it's the 10th link, existence in the previous life. And that manifested as a result of craving and grasping. And they follow the feeling link going back and back. So if we want to stop aging and death, we stop rebirth. We want to stop rebirth, we stop existence. If we want to stop existence, we stop grasping and craving, and we stop the feeling link. If we want to stop feeling, we stop contact, karmic contact with pleasant or unpleasant objects. To stop contact, we stop these six sources. To stop that, we stop the body and mind coming together at conception. To stop that, we stop the consciousness link, or the cause of consciousness, resultant consciousness. We stop that. How do we stop that? We stop creating karma, karmic formation, the second link. How do we stop that? We stop ignorance, the first link. So that's the weak link. Stopping ignorance, generating the wisdom, understanding, reality. And that is up to us. Any questions? Any questions? Yeah. You go. Speak a bit louder because I'm going deaf.
How does dissolving the first link of ignorance, how would that relate to the bodhisattva path? Like, would a bodhisattva still do that?
How do the 12 links relate to the bodhisattva's path?
Specifically, like the first one, dissolving the first link. Would a bodhisattva do that?
A bodhisattva?
Yeah.
What is a bodhisattva?
A being with bodhicitta, so...
A being?
A being with bodhicitta?
Yeah. What's bodhicitta?
Altruism and... I'm not too sure.
Yeah, all right. There are two types of bodhisattva, right? There's what we call the ordinary bodhisattva, who hasn't realized emptiness, but has generated bodhicitta, has generated the altruistic intention to achieve Buddhahood for the welfare of all beings, right? But the ordinary bodhisattva, they have not realized emptiness. Then there's what we call the Arya, the noble bodhisattva, who has realized emptiness. Okay? The ordinary bodhisattva still has the 12 links. has not extinguished ignorance, because hasn't reached that point on the path we call the path of seeing, where they nullify, they don't abandon ignorance, but they nullify the link ignorance. So, there, but of course, having generated bodhicitta, their mind is incredibly virtuous. And that, but they can lose it. They can lose their bodhicitta, well, technically, they can lose their bodhicitta right up to, just prior to realizing emptiness. In effect, they can abandon bodhicitta soon after generating bodhicitta. And there are examples in the scriptures. Just after initially generating bodhicitta, they can abandon it. But they will quickly revive it. So, they will have, from after that point, I think the second stage of the path of accumulation, they won't lose it. Technically, they don't lose it until the patience level of the path of preparation. But anyway, so they will have good rebirths throughout. The Arya Bodhisattva has destroyed karma. No chance. Is that right? Yeah.
I'm not sure, but that might be in terms of why would a bodhisattva want to get out of samsara so quickly if they're trying to help things.
Oh, I see. You...
I mean, was there something like that?
I'm not too sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
That would be interesting.
Well, look, even a bodhisattva on the 8th, 9th and 10th levels, like they've totally extinguished afflictions, they still want to take rebirth in samsara to help sentient beings. How do they do it? They have no karma. So they do it, we can talk about contaminated karma and uncontaminated karma. And this refers to what we've been talking about, the 12 links, is the contaminated karma. And remember, karma is effort. It is this intention, you know, a mental effort, which brings about all the experience of life, including rebirth. The uncontaminated karma of a bodhisattva, even on the last three stages of the path before Buddhahood, they've achieved the bodhisattva's nirvana, you know. They still have what we call obscurations to omniscience in their mind. Like the smell of the afflictions. They got rid of the afflictions, but they have the smell. And so they can, in order to be reborn in anywhere in samsara, from hell to the heavens, they can utilize the, a slight amount of effort or movement of the mind, which arises as a condition of the obscurations to omniscience, that through that they can take rebirth wherever they like to help sentient beings, and they do that.
Then does a Buddha never take? Is that a path?
A Buddha can also appear anywhere, but they do spontaneously. There is no movement, no effort whatsoever. A Buddha will spontaneously appear in multiple forms throughout the universe to help sentient beings where they're ready to be helped. Okay. I'm sorry we rushed through it, but I tried to get the essence of the 12 links. It is an important subject. I knew how important it was at my first talk at Inter McKim's place in Fitzroy, but I had no idea. Well, I did have some idea, I did meditate on it for 3 months. And if you like, I can tell you how it happens in one life, but the way I saw it happening, it's quite interesting. And I was very pleased to see that I wasn't the only one who had that idea, but many other Buddhists had the same idea. In the Hinayana path, you know, there are the solitary realizers, what we call solitary realizers. They achieve nirvana by meditating on the 12 links. Yeah? It's pretty powerful. It's not yet Buddhahood for them because they haven't generated bodhicitta, but they can totally achieve nirvana through meditating on the 12 links. Alright, so thank you for making me talk and think for the last 3 weeks. As I say, I'm a little bit lazy, but I've really enjoyed your interest and questions and the opportunity to share a bit with you. So we still don't know about Dorji and Genla's visa applications. Lama Zofa Rinpoche has recently said advice that we ask the school which Genla belongs to in Sirajay Monastery to recite the entire Kangyo, the entire teachings of the Buddha. Like all the monks will get together and they, all that up there. There's a lot. And so collectively, each one won't recite the whole Kangyo, but they all take a text and they're going to recite the entire Kangyo for Genla's visa and Dorji's visa, both of which are in great jeopardy due to, I have to watch my karma if I talk about the immigration department. Those lovely people in immigration department just don't know what they're doing. So let's dedicate the collective energy of these three talks to the success of Genla and Dorji receiving their visas, which is the big step towards permanent residency in Australia. Because without them, if you only got me, you got no hope. But the other monks and nuns, you've got a bit of hope. But me, I'm sorry, I'll lead you astray. Anyway, meditate on dedicating this energy towards the success of our visa applications for the benefit of the people of Victoria, of Australia, New Zealand, and the whole world. Okay. So thank you again, and have a very peaceful Christmas, and spread happiness and love wherever you go and whatever you do. Great opportunity. Thank you.